Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 214, and we're going to probe the fascinating and these days hidden history of Port Elizabeth, or Gqeberha, a bit about indentured Indians arriving in South Africa and a spot of Boer Republic rebellion. It's hardly ever a quiet day in sunny South Africa. First, Port Elizabeth. In the eyes of most folks of the South, the Windy City features as a minor point on the urban map and in popular consciousness. The people of the city, however, are fiercely patriotic and fiercely independent. Always smaller than Cape Town in terms of population size, never the seat of government, its enormous importance as a premier centre of trade and finance in Southern Africa has been readily overlooked. Yet from the 1850s all the way through to the 1880s, Port Elizabeth was called the Liverpool of the Cape, and for some years in that period was the centre of the Cape's economy. Coming soon, however, was the discovery of diamonds that would shift power to Kimberley. Then later in the 1880s, to gold, and power would shift again to Johannesburg. The period of the mid-19th century saw the financial heart shift from Cape Town to Port Elizabeth, although the elites of Table Bay continued to hold sway. A commercial elite of merchants, accountants, lawyers, and other professions controlled the economies of Cape colonial towns. Cape Town was the seat of government. Its population had grown to 25,000 people, and it was easily the largest urban centre in Southern Africa. There were only 17 joint stock companies in 1859. Only five towns outside Cape Town, Grahamstown and Port Elizabeth had local banks. There was a cosy and close link between the merchants of Cape Town and the government. Similar links existed between local government officials and merchants in the smaller towns, which enhanced the ability of local commercial heavyweights to control trade through their districts. There was a constant tussle between the local merchants and the businesses that controlled the ports. Port merchants were closer to the maritime traffic, closer to the heart of the empire, London, and acted like commercial filters between the periphery and the centre. Major commodities produced were all rural. There was no real manufacturing to speak of, except for tanneries and wagon mechanics. There was also net making, boat building, wool processing and spinning, shoemaking and tailoring, knitting, forging of iron, casting of metals, brick making, thatching, lime burning for mortar and whitewash, baking of bread and brewing, carving and upholstery, saddle making and basket weaving, calligraphy, typesetting, printing, bookbinding, weaving, ceramics, musical instrument making, gold and silver smithing, basic surgery and wound treating, midwifery. In a future podcast, I'll drill down into these industries with much more detail, but the artisanal skills in South Africa were developing. More than 40% of commercially cultivated land was in the southwestern Cape, dominated by wheat and other cereals. The most valuable crop by price, however, were the vines, viticulture. In 1855, wine and brandy were the two most valuable exports from the Cape, although wool was the main export. It was wool produced in the interior of Southern Africa that supplied the main impetus for urban growth in the colony throughout the 1850s and led to the doubling of exports between 1854 and 1865. All of this focused around Port Elizabeth. By the late 1850s, an aggressive group of bankers had emerged in the Eastern Cape, independently minded, the Frontier Commercial and Agricultural Bank, the Eastern Province Trust Company and the Eastern Province Mutual Life Insurance Company, all operated out of Grahamstown. There were at least half a dozen others in Port Elizabeth and more in Graaf Reinet, Colesberg and Craddock. All were trying to undercut the bankers of Cape Town. In 1857, merchant John Patterson gathered a few like-minded entrepreneurs around him and floated the Standard Bank of Port Elizabeth. It sank almost immediately. Funds were hard to come by. These merchants, however, had direct links with London. They bypassed the Cape Towners, and by this time, half the ships sailing between South Africa and Britain were leaving from Port Elizabeth. Patterson gathered his entrepreneur pals together again in March 1859 and sailed to England, where he launched his prospectus for the Standard Bank of British South Africa in April 1860. A group of Cape Town merchants heard about this. They were not to be outdone by the Eastern Cape upstart. And in July, the London and South Africa Bank, henceforth to be known as the LNSA Bank, came into being. Governor Sir George Grey was very interested in all these moves and is believed to have intervened to help the Cape Town Group as they negotiated for a charter and necessary capital. Port Elizabeth traders regarded the LNSA Bank in a negative light. Despite their reservations, they could not deny the power of the bankers of Cape Town. A branch of the LNSA Bank was opened in Port Elizabeth in 1861, and eventually the Standard Bank's progenitor, Patterson, managed to scrounge together the funds, and the Standard Bank opened in 1862. Its first physical office opened a year later, 1863. Port Elizabeth now had direct access to loans, to credit, banking facilities managed by their own kind. Things were looking up. This was the time of loads of dosh pouring out from wool farms, but the boom, as all boom experts know, can end up going bang. The wicked Australians were competing with the Cape farmers. Their wool was of a superior quality, and now the flood of cash into the South African farming system was pushing up inflation, which made Cape wool more expensive than it should be. Transport in Southern Africa in the mid-19th century was unsophisticated. The backbone of the system was the slow ox wagon. Journeys between the ports and interior towns were measured in weeks or even months. The 480-kilometer journey from Prince Albert to Port Elizabeth took 3 weeks. It also took a week by horse-drawn carriage between Port Elizabeth and Cape Town, and about the same time between Port Elizabeth and Beaufort West. The merchants could not contribute much towards the upkeep of these routes. It was just too expensive. The Cape government had to build roads and bridges largely because of military requirements, and by 1860 it was spending over £120,000 a year on transport infrastructure. When government needed to borrow cash, it was charged 6% interest by the London banks, double the rate for loans inside the UK. Labour strikes became quite a thing. For example, in Table Bay, boatmen demanded a 50% wage hike in 1854 and won their demands, but that pushed up all costs, and merchants and boat owners increased their handling fees by 80%. There were strikes every couple of years. Beach and wharf workers downed tools in 1856 for better pay, which they were awarded, an increase from 5 shillings to 6 and 6, and from 7 to 9 shillings a day. To boggle the mind, I need to explain that £1 was divided into 20 shillings, 1 shilling was divided into 12 pennies, and 1 penny was divided into 2 half pennies, or 4 farthings. No wonder we use the decimal system. But 6 shillings in 1859 was a significant amount of money, about £18 in today's value. It was also the wage of a skilled tradesman in England, so South African tradesmen were earning the same, if not more. The freight handling in the ports of South Africa was primitive. Everything was done by hand, and roads led directly to jetties or even simple open beaches with no protection from the ocean. This couldn't carry on. Innovation was needed, or at least proper ports. In 1860, the Cape merchants persuaded the colonial government to proceed with the construction of an artificial harbour. A breakwater needed to be built. The problem was the cost. The Cape Parliament of 1860 heard that £250,000 would be needed to build this breakwater. That was twice the annual expenditure on all roads and bridges across Southern Africa. What really angered people in the Eastern Cape was what happened next. Most of the custom duty collected in East London and Port Elizabeth was going to be spent on building Cape Town's breakwater and other port facilities there. The split between the various Eastern Cape factions, Graaf Reinet versus Uitenhage versus Grahamstown, meant that the cunning Capetonians manipulated their parliamentary representation to develop their Table Bay harbour schemes. As we'll hear in future episodes, the coming railway revolution was going to upend the local politics still further. There was no Saam Vak Mensa going on in the Eastern Cape. Incredible things were going on globally in 1859. In February, United States Congressman Daniel Sickles shot U.S. District Attorney Philip Barton Key for having an affair with his wife. Some things never change. The army of the Kingdom of Sardinia marched against Austria, beginning the crisis which led to the Austro-Sardinian War. Indian Rebellion revolutionary Tansha Tope was hanged by the British, and crucially for South Africa, ground was broken for the Suez Canal in Egypt. Also crucially, The UK's general election of 1859 was the first fought by the new Liberal Party, in which they won a 28-seat majority with Liberal leader Viscount Palmerston becoming Prime Minister. Liberals in power! Now that was obviously going to have an effect on South Africa. The British Crown Colony of Queensland was established in Australia, and gold was discovered in Utah, the Comstock Lode, which led to a massive gold rush. Back in Britain, the chimes of Big Ben rang for the first time in 1859. Over in America later that year, Edwin Drake drilled the first ever oil well near Titusville in Pennsylvania, causing another rush, this time for oil. Just because history has echoes, you'll be interested to hear that in September 1859, Joshua Norton of San Francisco proclaimed himself His Imperial Majesty Emperor Norton I, Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico. America is now dealing with its latest emperor, Donald Trump I. In October 1859, John Brown raided Harper's Ferry Armory in Virginia in an abortive bid to spark a general slave rebellion. A year after presenting his famous paper on evolution, Charles Darwin published The Origin of the Species, and that great book sold out immediately. It continues to be printed today. Oh, and Karl Marx published his book, A Contribution to the Critique of Political Economy, a precursor to Das Kapital. While on the other side of the philosophical divide, John Stuart Mill published On Liberty. Many social matters were under scrutiny in this period, for in that year, 1859, the Society for the Employment of Women was founded in America. Author Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, who went on to write the Sherlock Holmes mysteries, was born in 1859, and Angelique Brulon, French soldier and the first female Knight of the French Legion of Honour, died. Engineer Robert Stephenson also passed on to that big locomotive in the sky in 1859. His inventions were coming to South Africa soon. He was called the greatest engineer of the 19th century and completely and utterly revolutionized world transport systems. In South Africa, a demographic revolution was taking place. The population was increasing rapidly. White immigrants were pouring into the territory, and indigenous people were thriving in between the wars and pestilence and cattle killings. Sir George Grey had planted 6,000 European immigrants in South Africa, either in the villages or on the small farms held on military tenure, mainly in British Kaferia, but also in Natal. German legionaries, their wives and children, and especially imported German peasants arrived between 1857 and 1860. These veterans of the Crimean War and their fellow German peasants had a marked effect on our history. The first place that felt the effect was in British Kaferia, then in East London itself. Hundreds of thousands of Germans were emigrating from their European homeland across the globe throughout the 19th century, for all sorts of reasons. In the 1850s, for example, 150,000 Germans emigrated to Canada. They were also settling in Southwest Africa, but there the numbers never rose above 20,000. Grey's far-reaching checkerboard system was truly a first in South Africa. I explained in a previous podcast how he placed the new German and British immigrants alongside black farmers. Think of a chessboard, black and white, back to back. This well-intentioned policy was to have ramifications, and eventually the name would change from British Kaferia to the Ciskei. The word Ciskei is an anglicization of the Xhosa word Tsiska, which means this side of the Kei. It also became one of the most congested, poverty-stricken and disorientated regions of South Africa, creating administrative nightmares for the magistrates. Luckily, say some, the British government stopped Grey from trying the same experiment of a black and white checkerboard across the Kei in the Transkei. South Africa was changing fast by 1860. In Natal, Grey believed the answer to the chronic labour shortage was the introduction of indentured Indians. These were to make their way to Natal over the next few decades, but Grey's initial request was rejected by the Indian government. The Cape Governor wrote letters to the Colonial Office and the British East India Company that demanded free passage home for the indentured Indians once their period of labour had ended. Grey was offering these cane cutters 6 shillings a month. Stevedores and wharf workers in the Cape were getting 6 shillings a day. The Indian government rejected the plan. They weren't being paid enough. And the Legislative Council in Pietermaritzburg tried to induce AmaZulu to work on the new sugar plantations by increasing the hut tax. This rose from 7 shillings to 11 shillings per annum for AmaZulu men not already working inside Natal. Those who couldn't pay were drafted into Izibalo labor, building Natal's roads. But the shortage of laborers continued. It was so bad that one land company imported Chinese workers, although they proved to be less than useful cutting cane and were sent home again. Eventually, the Indian government relented and agreed to send indentured laborers to Natal. But there was some resistance to the idea amongst missionaries and some of the settlers. Two ordinances were hurriedly passed in the Natal legislature, legalizing the public and private import of workers from India. Indentured laborers were on their way. Almost half of these were women, and they were allotted a 3-year contract with different English farmers. The pay was increased to 10 shillings per month for the first year, and they'd receive free food and lodging. By the third year, they were to be paid 12 shillings a month, most of which was docked to pay the Natal government for the costs of bringing them to Natal and for their return. At the end of 3 years, most of these labourers could re-indenture themselves for another 2 years, following which they were either free to go home or stay in South Africa, receiving the value of Crown land to the value of the voyage home. This concept was not unique. Indian labourers had been shipped across the world, first as slaves by the Dutch and early English merchants. They ended up in Mauritius and in Madagascar, crisscrossing the Indian Ocean for centuries, some voluntarily, mostly forced. The Natal plan almost backfired. The first Indian indentured labourers were disappointing, and the Indian government had reneged on the promise to send women. Only a handful showed up, and there were, as the Natal bureaucrats were to mutter, of a bad type. But from late 1860 onwards, this flow of indentured workers from India to Natal accelerated. The rest, they say, is history. Speaking of which, let's quickly take a look at what this flippant phrase indentured really means. These days, Indian South Africans are under pressure from xenophobe politicians who are afflicted by various diseases, including cretinism, asininity, fatuity, and laquitism. Xenophobes are like boils. Left untreated, the pressure increases, and like boils, xenophobes don't heal themselves. They must be lanced. Indentured labourers enter a contract, usually lasting 5 years, working in strict conditions, in exchange for the cost of passage, accommodation, and a minimum wage. It's technically not slavery, but it's coercive, and workers face hardship and exploitation. Indentured labourers are presently deployed in various Middle Eastern states to build sports stadiums. By the time the indentured system of Natal came to an end in 1911, more than 150,000 Indians had been brought to the territory, mostly from the states of Tamil Nadu, Andhra Pradesh, Bihar and Uttar Pradesh. Not only did they work on sugar plantations, but the burgeoning railways and later in the Natal coal mines, as well as forming the core of municipal service labourers. Most were recruited under misleading promises of wealth and prosperity. Travelling on overcrowded ships, the voyages were terrible. Diseases broke out. Many landed in Natal in a malnourished condition. Work-wise, the CCMA would have been very busy. These labourers ground away 9 to 10 hours a day, 6 days a week, in harsh conditions, receiving bad food, drinking filthy, dirty water. A dangerous profession. Their accommodation was overcrowded barracks and plantations. They could not leave their plantations without permission. They were flogged regularly for disobedience, hundreds trying to escape. They had fled India, where they had been treated even worse by local political despots. The Natal English settlers scorned them, so too did the AmaZulu. After the period of indenture ended, most of these Indian immigrants who brought their remarkable sense of entrepreneurialism into South Africa made the momentous decision to stay rather than return home. Many moved onto little gardens around Durban, and their culture and food diffused through South Africa rapidly, except for the Free State, where they were banned from settling from 1885 until the back end of apartheid, 1986. Powerful figures have emerged from this small group, including one of the powerhouses of the 20th century, Mahatma Gandhi. The cohesion and success of Indian South Africans has inevitably drawn the attention of populist politicians. A telling indictment of just how bereft of substance the modern political class has become. Speaking of success, that is not a word you'd probably have used to describe the Boer Republics of 1860. They were sinking deeper and deeper into confusion and outright impotence. The Transvaal was prodding the Free State to unify, and Transvaal President Martinus Pretorius was soon ushered in as president of both republics. But was he really? You be the judge. The failure of Grey's Confederation idea, unifying Natal, British Kaffraria, the Cape, and maybe part of the Free State, had given Pretorius the opportunity to make renewed overtures in Bloemfontein. In April 1859, Jacobus Nicolaas Boshoff resigned the presidency of the Free State and did what many do. He retired to the coast, to Natal, of all places, home of the British imperialist class. Still, it was warmer and the sea was inviting. Maybe he fished. The Free State Volksraad voted for Pretorius as their new president by a large majority, and everything seemed to be smooth sailing, except for some Boers in Kroonstad who rebelled. Pretorius led a commando south, crossed the Vaal River, and pacified the rebels of Kroonstad without a shot being fired. Then he dismissed the Bolshe Landdrost and rode into Bloemfontein. A Free State plebiscite was held, and a small majority voted to unify with the Transvaal. Further north, the Leidenburg-Utrecht Republic held out for a while, then threw in their lot with the place that was now being called the Suid-Afrikaanse Republic. Was Republican unity at hand, led by Pretorius and the Transvaalers? Well, not quite. The first big issue facing the new joint president was taxes. Free State farmers were averse to paying direct tax on anything. Pretorius was innovative and took aim at the customs duties levied at the ports, particularly Cape Town, Durban and Port Elizabeth. The goods transferred from these ports by wagon upcountry and vice versa had customs duties levied. Maybe he could convince Governor Grey to hand over some of this cash to help run the republics. By 1862, Pretorius was going to visit Cape Town personally to try and convince the British authorities there to part with some of these levies. As you'll hear in later episodes, this was going to be like prying a silver coin from the cold, stiff fingers of a dead loan shark. Meanwhile, the Soutpansbergers were in no mood to unify with Pretorius's Transvaal, and the Boer meetings in Potchefstroom revealed that many were nervous that the British would renege on their conventions granting the Boers their republics if the Free State move appeared to be against the interests of the British Empire. The Leidenbergers reminded Pretorius that they'd only given him 6 months' leave from local affairs to complete the union with the Free State, and there were more pressing matters at home. They believed his gallivanting in the Free State was beginning to undermine their own interest. So the Transvaal Volksraad decreed in July 1860 that Pretorius had no authority over them while he was in the Free State. The distances meant he could hardly expect anything else. He was absent, hanging around Bloemfontein, drinking coffee with the burghers of the Free State and not the burghers of the Transvaal. They also dismissed Pretorius' state secretary just to reinforce their position. The Raad didn't stop there. A few weeks later, they decreed that no one could be president of both the Free State and the Transvaal Republics at the same time. So Pretorius resigned his post in the Transvaal, handing over power to his deputy, Johannes Grobbelaar. That was a bit like Russian President Vladimir Putin handing over power to his groveling minion, Dmitry Medvedev, when everyone knew who really called the shots, or in Putin's case, the invasions. Grobbelaar didn't muck about. He and Stefanus Schumann of the Soutpansberg summoned Het Volk, the people, ostensibly to discuss what to do next. Then, amid remarkable scenes, Grobbelaar declared the Transvaal Volksraad to be defunct and reinstated Pretorius' Secretary of State, appointed a new committee to oversee a new election of a new Volksraad, and gave Pretorius 1 year paid leave to complete the union with the Free State. Needless to say, the fired Volksraad were none too pleased. Stefanus Schumann was enraged. But that, dear listener, was just the beginning of what some historians call the comic opera civil war between the Transvaal and the Free State. It was all handbags at dawn, because the Boers would not actually go to war against each other, but it was going to be darn close at times. Please rate the podcast on your favourite platform that helps elevate its visibility. You can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'll load an update about this episode. You can email me from there. Until next, goodbye.